Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From Hanselminutes.com, it's Hanselminutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 517. In this episode, Scott talks with Captain Brent Chapman, who works for the New Defense Innovation Unit Experimental at Moffett Field, California.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm talking with Captain Brent Chapman. You were a research scientist at the R.B. Simer Institute, but now you've just moved. I'm talking to you from your new location.
That's right. I'm now in Moffett Field, California, at the new Defense Innovation Unit Experimental.
That's very exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, it sounds like the Army is getting into to cyber things. You were at the Army Cyber Institute. I didn't know we had one of those.
We did, a fairly new organization, only a few years old, and it sort of follows the same timeline as the Army's newest branch, which is the cyber warfare branch. So after about 17 years or so, Army finally decided to create a new branch specifically focused on generating effects and conducting operations in cyberspace.
That's very cool. I want to dig into that. I want to find out about how that, as well as your journey to be a maker. But let's back up, because I went over to your website, your own personal website, which is at brentmorelabs.com. And it's just a great site with blog posts and projects and YouTube videos and stuff that you've done at Maker Faire and all these kind of things. It sounds like you've been tinkering since day one.
I have been, yeah. It's sort of my number one hobby, taking things apart, sometimes putting them back together. But really, it's all about sort of creation with tech and with building a sort of a way to express myself, sort of artistically too.
Mm-hmm. When did you start? Were you taking things apart as a toddler?
Oh yeah. So I'd say it goes back as, when I first moved to the States, my family and I immigrated to the U.S. When I was four, from South America, a small country called Guyana. Mm-hmm. And we moved to the city, New York City. And I remember seeing my first piece in technology. In fact, it was a radio, and just thinking like, wow, this is magic. It sort of blew my mind. So the next step for me was like, well, how does it work? I want to get into this thing. So I grabbed my dad was a carpenter, right? So he had his whole suite of tools. And sure enough, I made my way over to that toolbox and grabbed a screwdriver. And that's how it all began.
Why do you think people do that? Like, why are there people who want to take the toaster apart and other people just accept that the toaster makes toast?
I don't know. It's something that I kind of think about to this very day, especially as it relates to my work. We have a lot of products that are presented to us with a set of capabilities. And sometimes, we want to do something just slightly different than what it's built to do, mm-hmm. or marketed to do. But so it's kind of frustrating to know that, oh, you're so close, but if I can only tweak this one thing or add this one thing, this would be a perfect thing. And so for me, that's a huge motivation. And I think that certainly I wasn't thinking about that when I was four, but it's sort of evolved and matured into that to this day. So I like to see possibilities rather than the products. I like to see what else a cell phone is capable of doing. It can be a remote, it can be a flashlight. We know all these things, but taking that mindset to almost everything on a daily basis for me is kind of exciting.
Mm-hmm. When we're trying to encourage people to be makers and trying to encourage people to explore, how important is it to teach people that mindset of, go and think about systems and go and think about opening up, things that you already have and take apart stuff. Don't be afraid of it. How important is it that we instill that into beginners and makers?
I think it's critical. I talked to some of my friends and who they can remember back to their granddad, who loved getting his hands dirty and fixing something. Whatever it was, whether it was a car or some type of electronics. And that granddad sort of always knew or, you know, how things worked, or his first step when something was broken was to sort of just get in there. And, you know, but when I talk to my friend, you know, in this case, it's, well, why don't you do this? And they're sort of afraid. They're sort of, they've been growing up with, products with planned obsolescence, you know, products, that intimidate them. And so they've sort of lost that spirit of getting into things and trying to fix it first. Now it's more, if something doesn't work, you just sort of get rid of it and buy the new thing. And for me, it's critical when I educate or when I, you know, when I do my daily duties as a cyber warfare officer, I think it's critical to sort of get back to that and understand how systems work, knowing what you can do, knowing what rules you can bend, what rules you can break, in order to maneuver around the system, and to be more efficient about the way we go about things.
Mm-hmm. You said that your dad was a carpenter and you were doing this from age four and you were using his tools. I can assume that they encouraged you in this direction.
Not so much. I was actually kind of, you know, I was like, my brother absolutely hated me, because whenever he got a new toy, he sort of knew what that really meant. I got a new experiment. Yeah. Later that night. You know, and that's not really that strange, you know, in popular culture, like the maker or the hacker, you know, if you look at it from the computer security point of view, was sort of villainized forever and it's really only until fairly recently that it's now sort of become the cool thing with, you know, you can see the evidence in, you know, popular culture with shows like Mr. Robot, where it's now like the cool thing to be the one who knows how systems work and how to bend these rules. So growing up, it was kind of the same thing with me. Yeah. I was sort of the, not the wild kid, but just like I was destructive rather than curious is how they saw it.
Yeah. Yeah. I struggle with that a little bit. You know, every generation has their idea of what a hacker is, but like I was more of a phone person, right? Remember phone freaking and things like that?
2600.
Trying to figure out what, you know, what those tones meant. And when someone came and poked around on the phone system, they would plug their wires in and start sending tones down and you realize you could get free long distance.
Oh, yeah.
Someone told me I was voted most likely to be convicted of a white collar crime.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah. Not the kind of thing you want to be thought of at school.
You know, I look back to my teenage days and I was certainly, you know, I was in the gray space, if you will, right? I think I've atoned for that. I've done my service now and I'm all good. But, you know, that curiosity, you know, at the time as a teenager, you know, you certainly don't fully grasp the legalities and policy wise, you know, what you should and shouldn't be doing on other people's networks. But, you know, I was curious and I wanted to see, you know, see how far I could push things before, they sort of blew up in my face. I've definitely toned it down and matured quite a bit now. But I think still that spirit is so important in getting that across to kids that it's okay to experiment within reason, you know, to want to be curious, to find out how things work. And sometimes that involves taking things apart.
Mm-hmm. And exploring boundaries, which actually brings me to kind of an interesting, if not a little bit complicated question. I hope you don't mind. If you're a security person, if you're a maker, if you're an explorer, you're going to push boundaries, but I don't think of the army or the military as being a boundary pushing place. Is it hard to balance those two aspects of your personality?
It is, you know, and I aim to strike a nice balance on a daily basis. You know, the military, as you could imagine, is built and has been successful, especially, you know, the U.S. military has been very successful in working at scale and being very efficient at scale because of the rules and the policies and procedures in place. So something like making or hacking or even cyber operations, you know, there's some skills or some mindsets that are fundamentally at odds with that traditional military mindset. And so there's friction on almost a daily basis. And you know, if you design a system, for example, a military system, you can expect there to be lots and lots of rules. But if you're conducting cyber operations, even, you know, defense, you may need to bend those rules in order to come up with an optimal outcome. And with those two things at odds, you can see how it's very sort of can be frustrating at times. Because you want to be good. You want to be good at what you do and you want to have fun and keep people safe. But sometimes we get in our own way from the military point of view.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like the mindset for being a good hacker is different from perhaps being a good soldier, but finding that balance is what you're trying to accomplish right now.
That's right.
Yeah. And so when you think about making and stuff and doing, you know, work, I know that you did work with Maker Faire and you've published lots of Maker projects on your blog and on your site. Is that something that you can do on the side? You just tell the bosses at the Army, like, hey, I'm going to go to speak at MakerCon this year? How does that work?
Yeah, I think there's been I've been fortunate in that my last job at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, in the Army Cyber Institute, and here at the Defense Innovation Unit Experimental, you know, my bosses see this as a great thing because our, you know, their goal in both organizations was outreach, finding out ways to get the DoD, specifically the Army, you know, mm-hmm. back to the cutting edge where we used to be. And we sort of lost that luster and lost that edge over the many decades of conflict, of incredible influence by the defense industrial base. You know, you can sort of think of the large defense contractors and defense companies. Mm-hmm. And we want to get back to a better relationship, a more productive relationship, with the public. So when they see, you know, that I'm willing on, and I have the interest and I'm willing to, on a weekend or over the summer or what have you, go to the Maker Faires and the Maker Cons, go down to visit Adafruit, New York, for example, see mm-hmm. these maker spaces, see who the titans are, and want to create these relationships and strengthen these relationships. They think it's a great thing, so I'm going to keep doing it while as long as they let me.
Yeah, I saw on your blog that you got some pretty sweet invites. Not only did you go like to Adafruit, but you also saw a tour of the MIT Media Lab.
I didn't, and in fact, that was I was actually going as a prospective student for that visit, so that was kind of neat. Yeah, it's. The Media Lab is one of the few places, as you know, in the country where you have this really nice mix of tech and arts and math and engineering. But you know, they've had quite a history and they've been doing it very successfully for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So you're able to balance all of this. You're doing work, you're doing your job.
Yep.
You are a fairly recent master's degree graduate from Carnegie Mellon, if I understand it correctly. How are you managing all of this at the same time? I know that it's all I can do to do a podcast, have a full-time job, and get the occasional Arduino project done. How are you managing all of this 26 hours a day?
Yeah, well, I think the key is that I love everything that I do, right? I love my job. I love what I do. In the military. I love what I do in my garage or my basement, right? Mm-hmm. I love learning. And so it all is not really work for me. You know, I haven't worked a day in my life, right? so I'm fortunate that way. I know a lot of folks really don't have that luxury, but it's worked out for me so far.
Mm-hmm. So thinking about some of the tools that you're using, you know, I was talking to someone recently who was working on a movie or a TV show, and they're, you know, doing techie type stuff. And we joke sometimes as techies about how uncomfortable the dialogue is in TV shows, except for, of course, Mr. Robot that you pointed out is one of the great shining examples of tech done right on TV. And, someone used the term, military grade, which makes me always think about like that rugged Panasonic tough book. You know what I mean?
When
I think
about military grade. That's almost unusable. Yeah.
You're right. But, I realized that in the last 5 to 10 years, like Arduinos and Raspberry Pis and these small, tiny devices kind of came up. Is that something that was around? Did we have these miniaturized full spec computers before? And has that changed? Is that something the Army is aware of? Is the military realizing that computers can be, you know, hidden under someone's tongue?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You have, you know, so this has been a fairly recent phenomenon, these sort of microcomputers, microcontrollers, right. At the price point, right? I mean, they've been around for a while, but just prohibitively expensive. Mm-hmm. And the military is certainly aware of these, but you got to think about it from, you know, the military acquisition process is something that is, you know, I don't wish upon my worst enemy having to go through. Mm-hmm. You know, we look at a piece of X, so whether it's a tank or a fighter jet or a helicopter, or a computer. And mm-hmm. we say, well, we need this thing to do these number of tasks. Mm-hmm. And so we spend some time making this list of tasks that this device is supposed to do, right? A mm-hmm. tank is supposed to be able to withstand so many rounds or this type of, you know, concussion.
Right.
Of force. And so we spend some time writing these tasks and what we want this tank to look like. And this takes a lot of time. Then we have to, you know, bid it out and get someone to build it. And these things take years and years and years. Mm. The military is trying to apply that same sort of scheduling and construct to technology. you know, like sort of lower end technology, if you think about it, to computers, to desktop computers,
right,
to microprocessors, microcontrollers. And it just doesn't work because in the same 8 years that it takes you to, you know, as you would a tank in terms of setting everything up, you know, in that same 8 years, this is, you know, Moore's law comes into effect several times over. And that device that you initially sort of made the list of competencies, and bid out for and wrote this contract for is now obsolete several times over. Mm-hmm. So we've got to, as a DOD, come up with an alternative to an something that works well for, you know, for certain types of acquisitions, but we need to come up with an alternative specifically focused on this tech. So we're aware that it's out there, but we have to fix the system on how we actually acquire it for use in DOD.
Hey folks, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about Raygun and their new product called Pulse. Raygun is an error and crash reporting software provider, and their new product, Pulse, it's a real-time user monitoring product. It gives you performance data and user insights, lets you understand exactly what's happening when users interact with your software, so you're never left guessing. Raygun provides you with the answers to your performance questions, and they've found over 10 billion, that's billion with a B, bugs in customer apps with their crash reporting product. And now Raygun will help you understand application quality like no one else. Over 30,000 developers worldwide can't be wrong. I use Raygun all the time and I enjoy it very much. You can try it out today with a no-risk 30-day free trial. Start improving your software quality immediately. Try Raygun for free today at raygun.io.
I was talking to someone from NASA recently, and they were also talking about the idea of reliability versus, hey, this is fun and cool and exciting. You know, there's not a Raspberry Pi sitting on a Mars lander robot because not only is it, there's the acquisition that takes years, but also that we don't know if that's a reliable thing.
Yeah, don't get me
wrong. But we do know that, we do know a 486 is an extremely reliable thing. So that's why 486 processors go to space.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's, there are reasons and there are great upsides as to why we have this rigid process rather. And that's, you know, perhaps a good thing about the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Is
absolutely.
That we, you know, we're guaranteed that the thing, or we're confident that the device is going to perform as was described to us. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think there, you know, that works, but what if, you know, at the price points for some of these devices, maybe you don't need it to work 100% of the time. And maybe we shouldn't aim for 100% to be the standard. Perhaps as 80% solution will work if it's cheap enough, right? We talk about
really
obsolescence
point.
In devices. If this device that does this cool thing works 80% of the time, but it costs me $100 to acquire, well, then I'll just acquire 10 of them instead of buying the $1,000 device that'll take way longer to acquire.
Mm-hmm. So that's acquisition when it comes to like official, you know, army type stuff. Mm-hmm. But I understand that you're also trying to encourage the creation of maker spaces on post. Are those maker spaces something that people who maybe aren't doing the job that you're doing, like just kind of regular rank and file army people, could come and get involved in and learn about making as well?
I am. I'm really excited about this initiative. And this is, you know, perhaps this makerspace will be on post. Perhaps it'll be just off post in, you know, in the community, because after all, we're trying to, help form better relationships between the military and the public. So perhaps being off post might be a better option just for folks to get visibility on service members and sort of see that service members are people too and are makers too, you know, that's kind of fun. And on the converse, you have, you know, service members, folks in the army, for example, learning from the community, because we have a lot of talented engineers and educators and students out there in the community that don't get the chance to interface as much as we'd like. And we also think it's pretty important to look at these makerspaces as perhaps, we have engineers and technicians in the army, but we have some infantrymen, right, that are really technically talented and just didn't know it. That they're makers and they're working on their cars. And you know what? They're making in their free time. They just don't call themselves that. So perhaps this makerspace is a way to identify them from an already existing talented pool of soldiers and individuals that, you know, these folks are out there, and this can help highlight some of those skills and make them proud of it.
You know, that's really interesting. That term maker, there's been a lot of discussion about that. And there was interestingly a Medium blog post a couple of days ago where an individual basically thought that was a bad name, that the term maker put too much emphasis on creators. Mm-hmm. Like we all have to go out and create and be unique snowflakes and stuff. And sometimes just tearing things apart and plugging them in differently and putting them back together again, is, you know, has value as well, or being a really good consumer of something.
Yeah.
Do you think that this term maker is being overused, and that is there a negative connotation to it? Is it exclusionary?
I don't know. This might be quite biased, but I think that I see nothing but good things in the term maker. I'm seeing it more and more, certainly, you know,
right,
between all the various events from Maker Media and the publications and those types of things. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a very positive light on the term maker.
Yeah. So, yeah, I tend to think so as well. I realize that not everyone can be a creator. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people maybe ascribe the, you know, sense of consumerism. And, you know, when I say maker, I think about solving problems less than I think about creating products to sell. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're making you're making products, and you're also making solutions, which are, of course, less tangible. You know, ideas are hard to get our minds around in terms of, you know, when you're creating something physical, you have a much more visceral reaction, right? Because of course you can handle it and touch it and things like that. But you're sometimes just creating a process, making a new process, is almost as valuable.
Right. I really like the idea, and I'm hoping that my children have the same sense of the, and also my partner Saran, who I'm working with on with this March is for Makers. .com all the month of March, is the idea that making something or being able to make something is a sense of power and empowerment. And I think that it would give young people and people in general, for lack of a better word, you know, a straighter back. You walk more tall when you know how to do things. You know, like woodworking is just so visceral, and so you have such a sense of accomplishment. And I feel the same way, whether it be soldering or whatever, you know, and we should all have that feeling of power.
I agree. I think it's, you know, one thing I didn't like seeing in my classrooms were, you know, the sort of the techie student sort of revered for his prowess, on the, whether it's a computer or a phone or, you know, whatever technical thing. I'm a technologist at heart, but I still thought that was kind of a negative thing. I wanted my English majors and my history majors to be just as involved and just as excited about the possibilities of these wonderful technical tools as this computer scientist was.
Right, exactly. Imagine what we would feel like if we were talking about being literate, reading, and if someone was a naturally good reader, we would revere them and make the other kids feel lousy about not reading. And then eventually the kids would just give up and stop reading altogether. I feel the same thing happens with, you know, quote unquote computer people or techies. Well, you get self-identified as a techie.
Yeah.
And there may be cultural reasons, economic reasons. There could be any number of demographic reasons that may cause you to either be identified or not identified as not being a techie. If we did the same thing to numeracy or literacy, I think we would be up in arms and we'd say this is unacceptable. But we seem to think it's okay for computer people to do this.
Yeah, I think it's improving though. We're getting to the point where we're realizing as a nation, as a society, that, you know, computers and cybersecurity aren't really technical issues. You know, there are human issues that are, you know, and the computers and our connectivity are the tools behind it. So I like looking at a lot of these things that I talk about, especially in security, from sort of the human lens. I mean, we have all these whiz-bang products and the latest and greatest firewalls, but at the end of the day, you know, these are humans using it. These are humans making mistakes. And sometimes we're looking to exploit these mistakes to our advantage, right? And we're looking to prevent that from the defensive point of view. So if we can learn to appreciate our technical world, our technically saturated world from more of a human lens, I think we could be better off.
Mm-hmm. One of the shows that I did recently that got a lot of people thinking, where a woman named Keisha Rogers said that we should stop teaching kids how to code and start teaching kids how to think about systems and how systems fit together.
Mm-hmm.
And that systems level thinking is something that was being completely de-emphasized as we run around frantically trying to get kids to learn Python or for loops. What do you think about that?
I think she's got it. Our world is obviously becoming much more interconnected, you know, on a day by day basis. We have, you know, the Internet of Things has been the buzzword for a while. Our computers, phones, fridges, toasters are now interconnected. And, you know, if you told me this 10 years ago, I would have said this, well, that's ridiculous. Well, imagine what the world will look like in 10 years from now. You know, there are things that'll be out there that we can't even wrap our heads around right now. But you look, when you sort of take a step back, you realize that these are all systems. These are all many times unique systems that have their own set of rules. And we're finding really, really clever ways of putting them all together, for hopefully to make things easier for us. And so if we can take it from that point of view, understanding that these are systems of systems and seeing what lessons we can learn from that relationship and that interconnectedness, I think that's the way to go rather than, you know, thinking about it strictly from a low sort of low level technical point of view, understanding what they are in terms of systems is an awesome thing.
I feel like layers of abstraction are getting so, the layer is so opaque now that people just take certain aspects of technology as just being a miracle.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the downsides of, you know, the wonderful products that we get from, you know, the major companies, tech companies is that, yeah, they make our lives easier, but it's, we're almost becoming numb to how incredible, this technology really is and how much effort goes on behind it. These, you know, things just work now. You know, when I was growing up, computers didn't just work. There was always some aspect you had to troubleshoot. And in that troubleshooting process, you were going to learn something for sure. Now things just work. And if they don't work, it's, well, let me just throw it out and get another, or let me restart it or something. And there's not much learning going on. So if we could force ourselves to think about what's going on behind under the hood, force our students to do the same, I think we'll be much better postured for understanding from a security point of view, why these things fail and what we can do about it. And just from a usability point of view, you know, sort of get a better appreciation of these products.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. Just last week, I had a new iPhone, and every 5 minutes, like clockwork, it would drop a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And I put up with that for a week, not because of any poorly placed loyalty towards Apple, but because I really wanted to know why. You know, is there a loose wire? Is it a antenna issue? And I actually spent a lot of time at the Apple store trying to get them to tell me something, and they wouldn't go any deeper than, yeah, that is weird. Let me go ahead and swap that out for you.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I really want to sit here and I want to root cause this with you. Well, I don't really want to root cause it with you. I just want to give you a new phone. Mm-hmm. So this went around for a week and basically I just got a new phone. So now I will never know why this thing would loot, you know.
Yeah. And you'll be thinking about it forever.
Why every 5 minutes? But I can't pop the thing open because it's disposable. And that's just ridiculous. A quad processor, magical device, supercomputer in my pocket that is now disposable.
Yeah.
They just swapped it. It was surprising. So what kinds of IoT projects are you doing at home? I loved exploring on your blog. You made your own height adjustable table out of some mahogany and some legs that you got.
Oh, yeah.
You got all sorts of great projects that you're working on. What are you currently tinkering with?
Let's see. So, as you mentioned, one of my favorite things to do is, of course, tinkering. But I'm also a huge woodworker. So whenever I can combine the two worlds, you know, I absolutely love it. So I actually built that desk for my wife, who is, we have a home office. She's had a home office for a while. And so, you know, the big trend are, you know, these standing desks. So I said, you know, yeah, I can make one of those and make it prettier or make it cooler or whatever. So I built one and she's loved it. But I started to get a little jealous. So just, a few months ago, I finished a second one, for myself in my little, I've got my soldering station there and everything else. So whenever I can combine those worlds, I absolutely love it. I'm working on right now I've got two small dogs, right? And, I built a doghouse a few years ago. And now that we're back in sunny California, you know, it's out there and I think they'll get some use out of it. But I'm looking at adding a few sensors to this doghouse. So it's sort of, the door can open whenever they get nearby, can get some status updates on where they are exactly, if they're sleeping in the doghouse, that sort of thing. All maybe powered by a Raspberry Pi. I'm not sure yet. I haven't selected it, but I love combining all those worlds.
When you pick a project like that, like if someone who's listening is thinking like, oh, that sounds like something that I could do, how much time do you spend thinking about, you know, the components and having confidence that you can write it from scratch versus seeing if someone else has made a doggy door opener, you know, project all in one. It sounds like you're probably more of a looking at, like what level of Lego piece are you looking for? The complete solution and you follow the instructions, or are you thinking about wires and chipsets?
I think there's, it's probably split for me. You know, of course, the first thing I do is, you know, see what else is out there. I'm not about to reinvent the wheel if I don't have to. And there are a lot of really talented folks who share freely, of course. And that's the beauty about the net is that folks who like to do this tend to document really well, and their plans and their successes and failures. So that's the first place I look. And sometimes, in fact, you know, I'll have an idea. I'm sure that I want to do a certain thing, but then I'll look online and I'll see, you know, some that I hadn't considered. And then, and that in turn can help refine my idea into something even greater. Sometimes I do have to sort of roll my own code, right? Or invent my own way of doing a certain thing, but that's kind of fun. It always starts out though, seeing what else is out there. And that's the coolest part of the whole learning process, I think.
I really find more and more that I do solutions that solve a particular problem. I really admire people who can make art related installations where they can do something and I'll ask them why they did it and they'll say because it was pretty or because it was awesome. But for some reason, I keep looking for problems in my house and then wanting to fix them. So like the idea of a smart home for pets, that's like, I can get my brain around that and I can jump into that.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I could do an art installation for no other reason than it is pretty. I think that's just how I'm wired for wanting to solve problems.
You know, what's interesting is that I would say that I agree, but I think back to some of my projects, that have to do with something artistic. So whether it's a sound activated light display or an LED cube or something. And those are, that's art. And I had my fun in terms of soldering all the joints and things like that and planning out the circuits. But in the end, what do these things do? Well, nothing really. But they look pretty. So I don't know. I wouldn't sell yourself short there. I think you're probably plenty artistic if you think about it.
Well, like you have a great LED cube number two that you did there, that's huge. What do you got? 64 LEDs in an array. Do you still have that?
I do. It's a 4x4x4 and it's sitting on my desk here, on my shelf here.
And it's sound activated as well?
This particular one isn't. I have actually the table that I described, my little soldering, my electronics Benson soldering station. I glued a strip of LEDs to the back of the table so that when it is sound activated, the light reflects off of my white wall. So it gives this cool glow. Whenever I'm playing music or whatever, it's kind of neat. It's very soothing, you know, if you're putting on some jazz or some classical while you're smelling, solder fumes. It's fun.
I think I'm going to make the arc reactor that you did a couple 5 years ago.
Yeah. I really like that one because, I was in the middle of Afghanistan for that particular project.
And, oh, really?
Yeah. It was in October. So approaching Halloween. And as you could imagine, there's not a whole lot of Halloween party planning in the middle of Afghanistan. But one thing they do have is a lot of like stuff, broken stuff. So whether they're optics from aircraft that, you know, have bullet holes through them or all types of, stuff that was upgraded, tech that was upgraded and disposed of. So there was tons of parts that I had access to. And so I thought, you know, I'm not going to let this Halloween pass by without a little fun. So I found a couple LED rings and I built my own power supply and hid it under my uniform. And so Halloween night, you know, there are folks sort of around getting dinner and trying to have a little downtime in between operations. I made it so that my Iron Man arc reactor that was hidden underneath my uniform was, controlled by a remote in my hand. So you can imagine the surprises. I'm walking around the FOB, the forward operating base, and this LED globe is slowly starting to get more and more intense underneath my uniform. It's kind of a trippy sight, but folks around me loved it. And so it's sort of, you know, it brings a sense of calmness. It was fun for me, but it also helps, helps everyone remind themselves of like, you know, what fun is when you're out there in those tough times.
Yeah, definitely. I'll be sure to include links to your blog, to your projects, and in this project in particular. I think the other thing that surprised me about this one was that you powered that arc reactor with a 13.5-volt battery, and I'm looking at a picture here where you actually cut open a 9-volt battery and made a 1.5 9-volt battery power supply, which I've never done that. I never thought to open up a battery and see what was in there.
It's sort of what I had at the time, right? I had like these weird LEDs that had a certain power requirement and I didn't have the exact thing. So I took apart a few batteries and just sort of made it happen.
That's fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you chatting with me today. This has given me a lot of inspiration about how to apply these things, not only to my personal life, but also at work. And I really admire what you're doing down there.
Great. Thanks so much, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.